I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. This is News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM and 100.5 FM. That's the late, great Johnny Cash singing the iconic song, I Hurt. And we have our guest, Beth Andrews, who this is a serious subject, and she is a co-founder of Hope Counseling Services, with a focus in areas of alcohol and drug counseling. Welcome to the show, Beth.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, as we start, you know, I want to talk about these issues. And here in Maine, it feels like this, particularly over the last few years, more and more focus on local drug issues and the complexity of youth and the pressures and how young people are dealing with that and the tragedies that occur. But before we go into your work, if you wouldn't mind giving a quick overview of your background and, you know, did you grow up in Maine, where you went to school and what brought you to Maine, and then we'll talk about the work you're doing.
Okay. Actually, I was born here in Portland.
People require proof of birth. You know, people in Maine are tough like that. If you come here a week after being born, they're like, yeah, not from around here. But you're...
Born and raised.
Born and raised. Okay.
Uh-huh. I actually grew up in Newburg, Maine, which is outside of Bangor.
Right.
Went to Hamden Academy, left the state for college and stayed away for several years.
Middlebury, right?
Uh-huh.
One of my colleagues here. In fact, we had, I think he took Latin in Middlebury because that's one of those wicked good schools. And we named one of our businesses Veridescence based on some sort of Latin connection from beautiful Middlebury, Vermont.
I did not take Latin.
Okay. But did you ski? Because there's supposed to be a ski hill right there too, right?
There is. Yep. I was on the ski team the first 2 years.
Fantastic.
And then...
And was it in your undergrad that you were drawn to clinical social work? Or
no.
What was, you know, after you graduated Middlebury, what was the impetus to get into this field? And then talk a little bit about your credentials in this field, and we'll talk about the work of Hope Counseling.
Okay. No, actually, I majored in East Asian Studies at Middlebury.
And for people that may not have a globe handy, well, you know, define East Asian Studies.
I learned to speak Chinese.
Mandarin or Cantonese?
Mandarin.
That's the better one. I was just in.
Covers a few people.
I was just in Shenzhen, China.
Oh.
I wouldn't kid you. I went to Hong Kong, then I was in Singapore, and then I went to Macau, and then I spent 2 days in Shenzhen. And I can't speak anything, but I was there. And as you may be aware, that's one of the technology manufacturing capitals of the world, where, you know, many Apple products and other electronic products are manufactured. And it's both fascinating because they have hundreds of thousands of people producing, manufacturing these high-tech items. But there's also a lot of sadness and a high suicidal rate because it's, you know, there's a lot of elements there that are oppressive, right?
Yeah, they could probably use a few more mental health workers there too.
I think they could almost everywhere. So after you studied that, what then brought to you to counseling?
That's actually a long story that I won't go into a whole lot of detail on. But I realized that the corporate world was really not for me. It took me a little while and a few jobs to figure that out. But I ended up bartending for a while and trying to figure things out.
Wow, good environment because there's a lot of dimensions of humanity on display in the bartending world. You see a lot of...
There's a lot of good and a lot of bad.
You see a lot of despair. You see it's counterintuitive. Like people think, you know, we'll talk about alcohol and drug abuse, but people kind of think of bars as happy places. Many times they're kind of sad places, right?
If you spend enough time there and get to know what you're looking at, yes. So I actually, that's how I put myself through grad school.
Oh, fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a licensed clinical social worker, also known in the business as LCSW, talk a little bit about Hope Counseling Services And as I'm looking at my notes, I asked Emily, our producer, I said, well, HOPE, that's interesting. What does that stand for? And she was like, well, that's a great question for our guest. So Beth, HOPE, H-O-P-E, Counseling Service, what does HOPE stand for?
Healing, opportunity, purpose, and empowerment.
Well, I'm going to write this down. Healing, which is self-explanatory. Opportunity is a little amorphous. Is that the opportunity for personal growth, mm-hmm. the opportunity for greater self-awareness? Open campus, right? Opportunity for anything. And then P was?
Purpose.
Oh, yeah, we need to be purposeful people. And then E is?
Empowerment.
Emily, yeah, we've got that down now, right?
We'll never forget it.
We'll never forget that. That'll go.
Got
on the,
it now.
That'll go on the synopsis for this radio interview.
Definitely.
So, talk about in general setting up the practice, and I believe your practice is in Yarmouth. And mm-hmm. I should say this is, I think, the first time you and I have met, but my wife attended one of your talks. I think about a month ago or 2 months ago at NYA, and we have two teenagers, and. She was, as well as other attendees, just not only really impressed with your presentation, but very thoughtful about the subject and what it mm-hmm. means for families and teenagers and communities in general. So when she came home, she said, you must have Beth Andrews on the radio show. So that's kind of how we were introduced. But talk about the practice, what you specialize in, and then let's talk about some of the issues that are kind of timely and topical now.
Okay. The alcohol and drug counseling piece is something I came to after I'd been doing counseling for a while. I became passionate about it as I actually, my first jobs after grad school were in Connecticut and again in Georgia. And you're a lot closer to big city populations there. And that was sort of an eye-opening experience for a country girl from Maine.
Were you in Atlanta when you were down in Georgia?
I was. Yep.
I lived in Chastain Park in Georgia.
Loved it there.
So Buckhead is kind of almost a laboratory of social vices and abuse.
It is. And I worked in agencies or hospitals in both states, which is where I learned the business of counseling, substance abuse. It was when I came back home to Maine that I started working more with adolescents in this field and realized that the approaches that we use, this is 20 plus years ago now, for adults do not work with adolescents, and that really needed to be some modification and some understanding of adolescent development perspective.
What are examples of either techniques or approaches with adults that are effective with adults in terms of where they are in their development that are specifically ineffective with adolescents?
Do you mean specific to substance use?
Right. Is it punishment? Is it education? Is it, you know, obviously adolescent development and the neuroscience of what's mm-hmm. going on with young people just in terms of their brain development and their behavior is evolving. But are there any particular things that we've learned as a society or you've learned or people who practice social work have recognized that we've done it wrong for all these years, and here's kind of like specific examples of how we've done it wrong?
There's a history to substance abuse counseling that there was a very distinct divide between substance abuse and mental health treatment. And adults who have a substance abuse issue, well, actually, anybody who has a substance abuse issue is likely self-medicating something else, whether it's depression or anxiety or a trauma or something. It could be just about anything. So if you're just treating the substance abuse or if you're just treating the mental health side, you're really not treating the whole person. So I would say in the last 20 years, it's become a move to integrate and do what is called co-occurring treatment or dual diagnosis treatment, where you're doing mental health and substance abuse together.
And typically, this may be a naive question, but are they conjoined simultaneously, or is it serial or sequentially, where if somebody has a natural mental health issue that leads to some substance abuse or addiction issues, or is it that people that may have a predisposition in terms of brain science or the physiological makeup to abuse drugs that leads to mental health? Is it
could be either one.
Either sequence.
Chicken or egg scenario.
Or first, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to know after the fact. If they're already using and they've been using long enough to be identified as having a problem, it's oftentimes hard to know, did they start using and that created issues that they're now medicating, or other way around?
By the way, we have Beth Andrews here. She's the co-founder of Hope Counseling Services. When we talk about substance abuse specifically, and I want to spend most of our focus on teen and adolescent behavior, because I think there's a real crisis going on, and I also think that's an area where a focus of our resources can hopefully have a greater impact in terms of the rest of young people's lives. Are we talking about a specific set of substances, and people think of pot, and they think of various drugs and cocaine and harder drugs? Or is there a broader definition of substance abuse where weight issues and self-esteem issues or anorexia in terms of, you know, there's all kinds of substances that reflect something going on with a person, some pain or something that they're looking to mask? Or,
do you mean all sorts of behaviors?
Well, I was thinking for me, donuts. I'm joking. I'm thinking, behaviors. You know, we all... You know, there's all kinds of substances, or is your work very specific to the chemical aspect of substance abuse?
It has been, but not completely. I certainly have worked with people with eating issues, gambling issues, but far more often than not, it's substances, problems with substances that end up in my office.
And from your history of a couple of decades of working with young people and adolescents, it feels like we're hearing more of these stories and more of really tragic results of teen death, whether it's overdosing or whether it's, you know, we do a lot of work in the automotive space, and I've worked with a lot of federal and national insurance institutes, and the number one cause of death for teens is typically automotive, which is drunk driving or not being paying attention. So that's a real threat. But is something getting worse over the last two decades, or is awareness in science and behavioral science making us more aware, or are there some fundamental changes that are happening, or is it the underpinnings of adult supervision or two parents working? So, or is there something fundamentally different about today's teens that are making them more vulnerable or susceptible?
You've just asked huge questions.
That's what we do here at Tide Smart Talk, Beth. Huge questions.
Yes, there are differences, but I would say, too, that I think awareness is being raised. I just heard on the way here, actually, that last year there were 272 opiate deaths in the state, which is certainly raising awareness about drug abuse in general. I don't know the breakout, how much of that was adolescent and how much is adult. But at least in our local area, the drugs of abuse are alcohol, marijuana, and prescriptions. Right. Prescription pills not prescribed for that person.
Right.
There is cocaine. There are opiates and some other things as well. But those are the ones that our high school kids have most access to. As far as why we're hearing more about it, it's a big issue. The opiate epidemic is raising awareness. And I do think parents are tuning in a little bit more, which is good news for us. We have several in the state drug-free community grants, federal grants for 5 or 10 years. They're large grants, $625,000 for 5 years to raise awareness and reduce underage substance use. I'm part of the Casco Bay CAN, which is covering Cumberland, Yarmouth, North Yarmouth, Falmouth, Pownall, Gray, and New Gloucester.
Gotcha.
And we are in the 6th of 10 years of funding, and our mission is reducing underage substance use. So there's a lot more awareness and a lot more money being put towards that effort.
I look back to when I was in high school. This was, of course, during the Jurassic period. And in Massachusetts, the drinking age was 18, mm-hmm. which I look back on that now, and many states, the drinking age was 18. And it feels absurd knowing 18-year-old kids now that there were adults of that generation that thought, yes, I think this human being is old enough and mature enough to be able to drink. And then there's the counterweight arguments, which makes the issue kind of complex, whereas if a young person is old enough to join the military and put their life on the line, they should be old enough to have beer and or the right to vote, which is the portal to our democracy. They should be able to have a beer. But to me, there's different issues in terms of brain science, maturity, and risk of life. But even that seems perverse. And the other question I had, which that wasn't a question, but it leads to one. Our approach here in the U.S., which is somewhat provincial, compared to Europe. So everyone hears the stories in Italy or Spain where you're 8 years old and you're having a bottle of wine with the family. And I don't know what the evidence is or the science or the research or the pure. But how is it that in some cultures, alcohol is introduced as almost a beverage? And what does that mean for those societies that face problems of alcoholism or addiction issues? And are we treating it effectively by having this rigid age limit, which I think it should be restricted at 21? But, you know, talk about the approach in the U.S. versus Europe and what your research may have shown on why it's different here in the U.S. or maybe it isn't.
It is different. And actually, that's one of the arguments that a lot of adolescents try to use with their parents, is that in Europe, they drink at younger ages and it teaches them how to drink responsibly.
Our arguments in Europe, my son went to China himself 2 months ago, and that's the argument my 15-year-old son made, which I'm going to China, there's no drinking age. And then he said there's no age on tattoos, and apparently there are girls that will give you shoulder massages. I had the argument, exactly, that's what I said. I'm like, no, my son, you're going to China for a cultural experience. This isn't game on. Yeah. But it is different.
It's not. The research now shows us that in all of the EU countries, except one, where the drinking age is lower, there are higher rates of drinking, higher rates of drinking-related problems, deaths, etc., higher rates of alcoholism than in our country. The only country that doesn't apply to is Turkey, where there's a heavily Muslim influence.
Interesting. We have Beth Andrews here. She's co-founder of Hope Counseling Services. There's a phenomena that is in the news frequently, and I'd love for you to talk about it from your experience and perspective as a licensed social worker. I call it the fun parent syndrome. And frequently you hear about it. A couple of years ago, I think here in Falmouth, there was a party, and I don't know how it was resolved as a legal matter, but there was some suspicion that parents were involved with hosting a party of underage teenagers. Mm-hmm. There was drinking involved. There was some arrests. There was some, you know, you hear about these parents that want to be the cool parents. They want to be the fun parents. Maybe themselves they were drinking or getting high as teens, and they want to be supportive, or in their minds they're thinking they're helping their kids mature faster in a controlled environment. But in my mind, it's really misplaced and it's dangerous. And what's your observation with the phenomena, and how and why are there parents out there that really believe, oh, I'm going to supply beer and they're going to be at our house, so that's going to make them safe in some way?
Well, first of all, it's illegal. And there's actually a social hosting law in the state of Maine that if parents host, even unknowingly, they could be in jail for a year and fined $2,000. If there is injury that results from that party, they could have up to $350,000 in penalties, and that doesn't include the treatment and medical care that somebody might need to have. So I don't think a lot of people are aware of that law. That's first of all. But second of all, there is still this belief that if we just take the keys, everything will be fine and everybody's safe and nobody's the wiser. And that's, again, illegal and simply not true. Actually, only a third of underage drinking-related deaths are automobile-related. The other two-thirds are suicides and falls and burning and other accidents. And that actually, that just doesn't even take into account the other things that happen, the pregnancies, the rapes,
right,
the other things that happen. So I think parents aren't aware, number one. And number two, they think they're doing the right thing. And I also think that this has changed over the years. I think 20, 30 years ago, it was okay to do that. And people got away with it easily, and it seemed sanctioned. And those are the parents now that were doing that years back then.
Do you remember that story, Sally? Was it Falmouth that it happened?
I do. Yeah, I think it was Falmouth.
It was Falmouth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it feels like, though, it happens, I don't know if it's seasonal, springtime. A lot of times, I think, with high school graduation, that becomes kind of a congregation event. Parents, you know.
That family paid a lot of money in fines.
Right.
A lot of money in fines. And they say they didn't even know what was going on, that the drinking was going on.
Yeah, I mean, there's a broader parenting discussion that ties to alcohol and drug use and addictive behavior. But a lot of it is, you know, being a parent, my wife and I have three kids, it's hard. It's complex. There's factors and influences all over the place. But for me, my personal philosophy is, you know, I love our kids and my wife, we love our kids. But as a parent, you have to both love your children, but also protect their health and welfare and make decisions that may not necessarily make you their best friend.
Right.
And, you know, we have a 25-year-old and 16 and 15. And, you know, when the 25-year-old was 15, 16, 17, I'm sure there were more than once when she said, you know, I hate you guys. I want to go out, or I need to go this weekend, or why can't I stay at so-and-so's house? And it's like, man, well, that's not going to happen. Well, let's, you know, come up with the right solution. And now I think she looks back and appreciates it and is openly saying, yeah, I'm glad that there were kind of guardrails relative to behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But it is easy for a lot of parents to say, oh, my, you know, and the thing that makes it really hard, I get this argument all the time, is when your kids come home and say there's this comparative moral standard or parenting standard where this kid is allowed to have somebody stay over. This kid is allowed to do this. This kid. And I usually just, as soon as that argument is presented, it's like, you know, I want to listen and talk and understand what you're saying, but I can't parent based on what some other parent is doing, which may or may not be the right thing. But then that becomes like every, you know, you hear the story from kids. Every other kid is doing this. Every other kid has a phone at age 9. Every other kid.
You're the only parent crazy enough to have to follow up and check up on me.
I know. You must hear that all the time.
In your
practice, because the pressure of being a teen or an adolescent, much of the pressure is driven through kind of the peer reality of wanting to, as you evolve from a child to an adolescent, you want to be accepted, and you want status or recognition or approval or whatever. There's a mix of things that we all as teenagers faced and kids face today. But, you know, the argument of these other kids are getting to do this, I've never gotten that, and you must hear that in your practice all the time.
I do, and I think that one of the biggest things that I tell parents is start talking to your kids and start talking early, and let them know, set up norms early that exist and are going to exist through high school and into college if they're still home, that involve talking to other parents, that involve knowing the parents of your children's friends, that even in elementary school and middle school, always calling and saying, my son says he's coming to your house. Is that true? And are you going to be there? And what are your rules?
I want to, you know, continue talking a little bit about alcohol and drug abuse, but I had a question that just kind of came up from what you were just saying. Connectivity, social media, digital media is a huge problem now.
And another addiction.
Which you can't go to any kind of public congregation point or walk around the old port or go to the mall. And we've become a society of zombies all looking down like something urgent is going to happen. And if I'm not looking at every instant, I am missing the moon landing. Something great is happening. But not only is it an addiction, which is a problem, as a licensed clinical social worker, what message would you have for parents? And I know it may vary by age group and by young person, but the issue of monitoring social media, monitoring cell phone use, monitoring web browser visitations, because where we used to be able to control outside influences that came into our children's lives, whether they're through association or through activities or through other people, where, you know, up until 15, 20 years ago, we may not like those influences, but we could create barriers, obstacles, parameters. Mm-hmm. But through the internet and through these little phones and iPhones, there's literally a world, some of it good, some of it academic, some of it just informationally, but a lot of bad that can come through electronically, through a device, and it can really not just be inappropriate or not just something that is like, hey, don't look at that, that's bad, but can really be damaging. What do you say to parents for teenagers or young people in terms of coming up with parenting techniques or parameters to be vigilant, but at the same time encourage positive development? But the internet and the access to all that stuff is scary.
It is, and I actually, there's a lot of answers I could give to that question. I think, first of all, that the online life that kids have now is really making it difficult for them to have face-to-face conversations. I think their communication abilities are falling by the wayside. They're eye contact.
I see that in people applying for jobs. Mm-hmm. I see it that people, you know, that and it's prevalent. It's going to affect the economy. It affects the quality of relationships or mm-hmm. communicating. Empathetic connection is being lost, yes. And people are communicating in little bits and bytes.
Right. So that's just one part of it. But as far as content goes and even time spent inhibits family relationships. So when parents ask me, my advice is to, within reasonable limits and with discussion with your child, which obviously that changes as they age,
right.
But limit the time that they're on and know what they're doing on there to the best of your ability. It would be fairly impossible to
completely
know
locked down
everything right. that they're doing.
With Wi-Fi and with all the other stuff, there's lots of porous places information can seep in.
Yep. I say no phones in bedrooms. No computers in bedrooms. Nothing good happens after midnight. It's affecting sleep. That's the other problem that's happening, is these kids are exhausted because they get a 3 a.m. text that they have to respond to.
Can I tell you what I've done? AT&T Mobile, and I think all the services offer it, whether it's Verizon, Sprint, or AT&T, has something called the AT&T Smart Limits. And as the parent and as the person that, we have our kids because they play sports and they need to have phones, you can program in exactly. And so for our kids, and I'm sure if they listen to the show, they'll be like, Dad, why'd you say that? Their phones are automatically shut off between, I think, 10:30 and 7 a.m., with the exception of my wife's number or my number. Mm-hmm. So if for some reason they're at a sleepover or they're at a camp or sports camp and they have to reach us, those become the exception numbers. And, you know, aside from the other things you mentioned, using the technology to at least set limits helps with the technology, as opposed to, did you remember to put your phone in the kitchen, that type of thing.
But I also, yes, I agree that anything you can do to make it easier is better, because this isn't easy. There's nothing easy about this, and we're all just trying to figure this out and how it impacts people as the world becomes more and more involved in it. But I also think, just as I said with around the substance abuse piece and setting limits early on, set the norms with your kids early on that I am going to be checking what you're doing. I am going to be your friend on Instagram. I am going to know who you're texting. I am going to probably randomly check it. And when you set those norms early on, that doesn't mean it's necessarily going to make it easy as they get older, but it's not a new expectation that you're all of a sudden putting on them when they become a freshman in high school.
Got it. Sully, since you're closest to being a teenager than either Beth and I, anything you want to weigh in and hear? Because, you know, you're a young adult, you're an adult, and, you know, you I'm guessing, kind of grew up during your high school years when the internet and cell phones were kind of evolving and becoming more prevalent. So what was your experience?
Well, it's such a hard thing because I didn't have a cell phone until I was a senior in high school, and that's because that's when I got a car, and that's when I was out on my own. And a lot of my friends were like that. You know, cell phones weren't in everybody's hands until I was in college. And so technology moves so fast that it's how could we possibly keep up with the effects on children or on ourselves? Like, I know that some nights my sleep is definitely deprived because I am checking my email or I'm watching a movie because it's easy, or it has to be impossible to keep up with the detriments of it.
Yeah, I mean, even the brain science of whether it's light or whether it's stimuli or whether it's – there's all kinds of research being done. None of it points to it's good. You know, none of it suggests it helps with, you know, sleep. REM or anything else, and there's all kinds of evidence that it's bad. It's bad for our development. We've got Beth Andrews here. She's co-founder of Hope Counseling Services in Yarmouth. It's a private practice. There's one area that is getting a lot of news here in Maine, and that has to do with legalizing marijuana. You know, we as a state, there was a statewide vote in Portland. There was a vote to legalize recreational use. There's medical use cards. In California, I think that was one of the first places it rolled out. And then in Colorado, it's basically the Wild West. And to me, it is and was a slippery slope, but it feels like we've lost the slippery slope, and it's inevitable here in Maine and probably across the country in the next 5 or 10 years. That pot will become legal. You know, everyone will say, well, there'll be checks and balances, just like with alcohol, under 21. But once it becomes widespread, and once it becomes kind of institutionalized and sanctioned, and once it becomes legitimate for tax reasons, and, you know, for me as a high school kid years ago, I never really got it, the whole pot thing. You know, I grew up in a generation where, you know, in the 70s, where there was all kinds of drugs. And for me, I think I tried pot a couple of times and it was like, I don't get it. And that was it. But I understand the argument. There's one argument that says relative, if we as a society have sanctioned alcohol as a legal product that is not just legal, but it is prevalent in every kind of social, hospitality, life event, celebration. It's been so normalized that alcohol is part of the fabric of society. And the argument is, if alcohol is treated that way, that with marijuana, that there's still addictive properties that are very real. There's impacts on the brain and behavior that are real. But you don't have some of the impairment issues, possibly, of alcohol, of driving impairment.
Oh, yes, you do.
Well, I'm saying what is the privilege. I think for people that I see that have gotten high, you see that their, you know, speech has changed, motor skills has changed. But the argument that I think many people make is, you know, pot mellows them out. What's your thought here in Maine, particularly where we are with the legislative process? And then talk about what you think that means, particularly with adolescents and young adults, because as it becomes legal for older people, the access to it will become even greater across the board, across all ages.
I'm lucky in my practice that when somebody brings that up, I steer away from it simply because I say to them, that's you and I aren't going to
either
make it illegal or illegal, right, sitting in here. The fact is right now it's illegal. And it's something that you're doing that's getting you in some trouble. So let's focus on that. So as far as my practice goes, that's where I can stay with it. As far as legalizing it and what that means for us, it is different than alcohol in that our body metabolizes it very differently. That's number one. And number two is, there's no regulation unless you buy it from somebody who's specifically licensed to sell it. You don't know what you're buying. You don't know the strength of what you're buying. You don't know what else is in it. You don't know.
But isn't that addressed in Colorado where the THC levels and the
buy it legally.
Legally.
But because possession is legal, anybody can
grow it, or, you know,
right,
there's all kinds of.
So you still don't know. And it's, and the Colorado experiment, if you want to call it that, is not going well at all. I know the marijuana lobby there would have you think that, but crime is up, violence is up, school performance is down, arrests are up, gang violence is problematic, absenteeism way up.
Could some of those things also be connected to alcohol? I mean, you know.
Well, the combination of alcohol and pot makes everything worse. Both drugs are dangerous. Together, they're even more dangerous.
Yeah, but my point about what you were saying about pot, which I agree with, but I'm just making the counter argument. All those things that you suggested are going wrong in Colorado relative to absenteeism and crime and all that, I think a person could also make the argument by having alcohol available or legal, there's more crime associated with alcohol. There's more addiction. There's more job issues of people being fired. There's more addiction. And what as a society is the answer other than education and awareness? But if we've become a society where we're using chemicals, alcohol being one, or other chemicals to deal with issues. And it just feels like I wish pot wasn't legal, not because I'm going to use pot or not use pot, but I've never seen the positive effect. I've never seen, you know, somebody who's like high saying, hey, I've got these great insights. I don't know. So for me personally, I would just assume that we didn't go down the slippery slope, because it brings us further into a point where, and really for me, it's more young people. You know, if somebody is 25, 30, or 40, and they really want to go into their house and get dumb drunk and sit there, it's like, okay, I don't think that's great. Or if they want to get high, okay, that's a personal choice as an adult. But, you know, there's generally some impact to families and healthcare systems. But when we have those chemical options and substances, and we add peer pressure, and we add all those things, and we have young people whose brains are developing, their bodies are developing, it opens them up to making choices at a young age that negatively impact the rest of their lives. So there's a kind of an exponential effect. And so I wish we just didn't even have pot, but it looks like in Maine we will have legalized pot.
You know, for me, it honestly doesn't matter if it's legal or not. The fact is that it's creating a lot of problems, and those are the people that end in my office. And alcohol is illegal too if you're under 21,
right?
Which would be the minimum age for marijuana. So no matter what, to me, it's a dangerous drug that whether it's illegal or legal almost doesn't matter. It's so available anyway. As a matter of fact, recently at a youth panel that we did, we asked the kids on this panel, is the legalization of medical marijuana making the issue of marijuana in general confusing for your age group? And the answer was no, because it's so available anyway that legal or not does not matter.
Interesting. We have Beth Andrews here. I think all of it is a serious discussion, and I think that understanding and trying to make good decisions kind of starts with talking about it, and I appreciate you being here today. On a more somber note, if not that what we were just talking about isn't somber, talk a little bit about what has been described as almost an epidemic involving teen suicide. And particularly locally, and I don't want to call out communities or schools, but within proximity mm-hmm. here of Portland, there have been a number of tragedies that I'll describe them as, where a number of teens got to a point in their lives where they thought that was the only option. And there may have been other factors and there may have been a complex mix of situations that led to those decisions, but it feels like it's happening more and more. There's more and more awareness. Is that driven by something that's evolving as a society that's impacting young people, or is it being reported more, or is it what's causing at least the awareness in the what feels like an epidemic of young people that are looking at making the most tragic choice possible and teen suicide going on right now?
I have a lot of thoughts on that. I think we just talked a few minutes ago about how socially connected they are online, but how that's affecting their ability to communicate and have empathy, which means they're not necessarily communicating face to face with people about how they're feeling and what's not going well in their lives. I think that that's a huge gap, and they may be I don't know about
the
specific situations, but I've certainly worked with an awful lot of kids who tell me that they're suicidal and I need to bring in their parents and I need to come up with safety plans and I need to make sure that they're okay. And often they're kids who are spending all afternoon online communicating with their supposed best friend who lives in Chicago that they've never met face to face.
Right.
And that's a very common scenario. You've heard, I'm sure, the cliche that suicide is a long-term problem, a long-term solution to a short-term problem. It doesn't feel short term to somebody that age, because at that age, all they have developmentally is now, and a week is a long time. And so if somebody's not aware of what's going on and what a deep, dark hole they're in, and do what they can to at least keep them safe as they figure out how to get them out of this deep, dark hole, that's when kids feel like they have no other option.
I think what you're saying about empathy is exactly right. My oldest daughter, I think it was a few months ago, we were talking, and she has cousins. You know, we live in Yarmouth, and she has cousins in Scarborough. And I was asking her if she had talked to one of her cousins, and I said, hey, have you talked to so-and-so? And she's like, oh, yeah, everything's great. And I'm like, oh, how's she doing? Great, everything's great. And I said, well, when did you talk to her? And she goes, what do you mean? I go, well, when did you? And she goes, well, I did a Facebook thing, and I said, hey, how you doing or something. She wrote back, great. And I said, well, did you talk to her by phone? No, I didn't do that. I said, when was the last time you drove 20 miles down to Scarborough? And she looked at me like that. You don't get it. So in her case, which is, I think, common for most teenagers and young people, the idea of their connectiveness or their empathetic connection is more of a transfer of either information or just kind of like digital connection, and they've many times lost empathy, understanding what other people feel. Mm-hmm. And the greatest, I think, mode of empathetic connection is live engagement. When you're with somebody, if you're holding their hand, if you're looking them in the eye, you feel mm-hmm. and experience more of the emotion. And texting something or putting something on Facebook may convey data or information, but it's a lousy mode of empathetic connection.
It's also seldom real or genuine.
Yeah.
It's most often what the faces that we'd like the world to see and not necessarily what's really going on.
And without putting you on the spot to provide a therapy session here, Beth Andrews, co-founder of Hope Counseling. You're based in Yarmouth, right?
Yes.
So Hope Counseling Services in Yarmouth. For anyone listening as a grandparent or as a parent with a concerned adolescent or teenager, or it applies to anyone, suicide and depression and dark thoughts can inflict anyone of anyone's age. But as we're talking about teenagers and adolescents, what are some of the things that should either be looked for, cause of concern, and then at that point, what are the right steps, whether it's calling a counselor, talking to somebody at the school, because most kids want to lock themselves in the room and be on their phone, but that may not necessarily, it may just indicate they're isolating themselves or there's a pattern. But what should parents be most sensitive about relative to it being a concern relative to a child's safety or personal health?
I think in general, the thing that people should be looking for is any big change. If somebody starts isolating after that's not been who they are, if their grades start dropping, if they change their friend group, these are warning signs for a lot of things. So, I mean, it could be a warning sign for substance use or increasing depression or any number of things. But big changes are probably the easiest thing to notice. I also think paying attention to what they say, how they say it, if they make statements that sound hopeless, that's something to really tune into. And one thing that I've noticed, and actually you read a lot about, is parents are really afraid to ask their kids, are you having suicidal thoughts? Are you thinking about hurting or killing yourself? Because they're afraid to put the thought into their child's head.
Interesting.
And the truth is that you're not going to put that thought in somebody's head. If it's not already there, that's not going to trigger a kid to say, oh, hey, that's a great idea. I never thought of that before. That's just not going to happen. If the answer to that question is yes, the thought was already there.
So are you saying that whether it's a close friend or a child or grandchild, that if you have some concern that the person could harm themselves, just literally in an appropriate way, mm-hmm. in a sympathetic, compassionate way, say, hey, listen, we really should talk about this. Mm-hmm. Are you having any of these feelings? Mm-hmm. And then if the person does convey they are, treat it seriously, because
absolutely.
It could be life or death. You never know where the divide is between making such a horrible decision. And
I also hear people say, well, I think she just said it for attention. And I don't care if she just said it for attention, because why does she need attention? Something's not right. Whether it is actually suicidal thoughts or not, there's something going on that she's reaching to a pretty desperate place to get the attention that he or she needs. So if a parent is really uncomfortable with asking that question, call a school counselor or bring them into a therapist. School counselors have no problem with asking those questions, and I have no problem with asking those questions.
I think some parents may hesitate to go down that path almost mm-hmm. because of their own stigma.
Right.
And as a parent saying, you know, every parent wants to think that their child is perfect, you know, and as soon as you kind of go down that path where my child said this or did this, and I don't think you can be too careful when you're talking about somebody's life, right?
No. Safety has to come before all else.
You used kind of you swapped a couple of pronouns in the last response, and the question I have is, Are there any nuances relative to gender in adolescent or youth behavior? Are there any elements where girls are more susceptible to areas of substance abuse or addiction than boys, or is it just non-gender specific?
It's fairly non-gender specific. Historically, there was some numbers that said that the act of trying to hurt or kill yourself was perhaps more violent by boys than girls, but recently that's not even borne out. So, and there's really no difference in numbers gender-wise in who has drug or alcohol issues.
We have Beth Andrews here. She's co-founder of Hope Counseling Services in Yarmouth. Final question, since we're talking about teens and youth, one common element in virtually every young person in Maine, virtually not all the case, is everyone generally attends school through high school. Are we doing enough in our educational systems? Are we doing enough through educational services to make teachers aware, to make teachers sensitive and counselors? Because in many families with both parents working, teachers have the most day-to-day contact. They have the most awareness. They're witnessing teen interactions. They're seeing behavior in sometimes extreme situations. Are we doing enough? And if not, what would you advocate relative to taking a different approach in our school systems, not just here in Maine, but across the country, to make teachers better informed and aware?
I'm pretty sure that most of the schools around here are doing a lot to raise awareness of possible suicidality or increased substance use. Teachers are being trained, school personnel, right down to the custodians are being trained to notice these things. But that being said, teachers see hundreds of kids a day, and they're not going to notice changes in the same ways that somebody at home is going to notice. It really, all of these talks have to start at home, and the schools definitely have a role and have responsibility, but the parents, the more comfortable parents can become with talking about difficult topics, asking hard questions, setting limits instead of being a best friend when it needs to happen, the more likely it is that our kids are going to stay safe.
Well, thank you for being here. That's, a great message to end with. And I know from my wife attending one of your presentations to a group of parents, how effective that was. It was effective to the point where she came home and we talked about it and we talked to our kids, and now you're on the radio. So I think that communication is, when it's done positively and with purpose, is really powerful. So thank you for bringing your communication here to Tide Smart Talk today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. We've had Beth Andrews in the studio. You've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM, 100.5 FM, also on TideSmartRadio.com. Thank you for listening, and we will be back next week. Thank you.